So thank you all for joining us. This is something that a lot of us in NES are very much proud of, welcoming one of our own back to Cornell. So welcome, Kaya, back to NES. I'm very, very proud and excited to have you here today, 5 years after graduating from NES with your PhD. Kyle, or should I say Dr. Anderson, is currently an assistant professor of Middle East history at SUNY Old Westbury. He will be talking to us today about his first book, which was recently published by the University of Texas Press. The title of the book is The Egyptian Labor Corps, Race, Space, and Place in the First World War. So without further ado, thank you, Kyle, for coming. And I'm sure we're going to enjoy your presentation.
Well, thank you, Ziad. I appreciate that. Let me just make sure I get the slides up here. Yes, you can see it's a real book. It happened. My first book and possibly only. I can't imagine doing this again, but maybe sometime in the future I'll feel differently. But yeah, Egyptian Labor Corps, Race, Space, and Place in the First World War. It's really great to be here and talk to you guys about this book because it started as my dissertation here at Cornell in the Department of Near Eastern Studies back, I think I started research about 7.5 years ago at this point. And I want to thank Ziad and Deborah and Mustafa, who were my advisors as I was working on this dissertation, and Munder and Ibrahim and all the other familiar faces out there. It feels really good to be here back at Cornell and talking about the culmination of all this work. So I put up a link and a discount code here. You can get 30% off. If you're interested, the book is titled, as Ziad said, Race, Space, and Place in the First World War. It's a subtitle. And what I'm going to do today is to basically lay out some of the main arguments of the book. It's changed a lot since it was a dissertation. And so I'll be looking forward to hearing people's thoughts about those changes. And then I'm going to dive in particular today and focus on the implications of my research for how we think about Egyptian racial and national identity. And I'm going to leave out a lot of the empirical richness from the middle of the book that talks about the Egyptian labor corps themselves and how they worked, how they were recruited. If you want to talk about those details, of course, we can do so in the Q&A that's going to follow this. But for now, as I said, I'm just going to read a few sections of the book that lay out kind of the main arguments around race and nation and identity, and then we'll take it from there. So the book.
Did you want to share screen?
Yeah. Right, to the Zoom. Great. Okay. Let me make sure that I can do that. Sharing my screen. And now the slideshow, and presumably Zoom land can see these slides now. So that's great. So let me start off by showing you guys a picture of a company of the Egyptian Labor Corps in Boulogne, France in 1917. So a company of laborers anywhere between 500 and 1,000. And during the First World War, the British recruited, I estimate in the book, about 500,000 Egyptian young men to work as migrant laborers to support the British during the First World War. Most of these men were recruited from the countryside. They were fellahin, they were peasants, and most of them, or at least a good portion of them, were recruited by force, by violence, and they were compelled to go and join the Egyptian Labor Corps. And they worked doing numerous odd jobs. They were stevedores on the docks of France and Italy. And here is a picture from Boulogne. Again, you can see the men unloading supplies from a ship. And this is actually before the invention of the shipping container. So nowadays, being a stevedore requires punching some numbers into a machine and having the cranes take the shipping containers off the boat. But back in 1917, you had to move everything from boats in boxes by hand. So this was a very labor-intensive job back then. And the men even did stevedore work in the Dardanelles on the islands of Mudros and Lemnos, in the Allied supply lines during the Gallipoli campaign against the Ottomans. And they actually landed on the Gallipoli Peninsula and were digging trenches when the Allies decided to land and try a land invasion in Gallipoli. That invasion, of course, was unsuccessful, as I'm sure you all know, but the Egyptian migrant laborers played an important role in it. And it's a role that most people are not aware of. Another thing that Egyptians did during the First World War is they drove camels laden with supplies. And the main place they did this was in the Sinai Desert. So as you can see in this picture in the background, what you see is the terminus of the railway, right? So before a railway was built during World War I that connected Cairo and Jerusalem, the only way that you could travel from Egypt to Palestine was by camel. And it took 3 weeks, according to some sources that I've seen. You had to disembark at the Suez Canal and then load everything onto camels, travel by camel to Palestine and then unload, right? And then, so that was in the early phases of the war, that was something that Egyptian drivers did, was they took supplies from the terminus of the railway as the forces were pushing through the Sinai, and they supplied workers, or they supplied the troops in this way. And also in the campaign through the Sinai and into Palestine, this is where Egyptians laid hundreds of miles of railway and water pipeline that ultimately connected Egypt and Palestine, so that by the end of World War I, travel time between Cairo and Jerusalem was 36 hours instead of 3 weeks. So without the Egyptian labor corps, this change of space and time would not really have taken place. And one of the fascinating things for me is that this railroad really provides the infrastructural foundations of the British Palestine mandate in the interwar period. A lot of the employees of the British mandate in Palestine started their careers working for the Anglo-Egyptian army and for the Anglo-Egyptian government back in Egypt. And after Egypt was granted nominal sovereignty in 1922, many of these men made their way to Palestine on these railroads and continued working for the British Middle Eastern Empire. So my book, The Egyptian Labor Corps, it documents the experiences of these men in the war, and it follows them through to the Egyptian Revolution of 1919, which happened right after the war, of course. But most importantly, I think, and what I'm gonna focus on today in my comments, is how the Egyptian labor corps was influenced by and also influenced contemporary ideas about the racial identity of Egyptians. And I think this picture shows these men kind of working on this railway, and it is evocative perhaps of scenes we might see in the American West, for example, where similarly racialized laborers were called upon to construct railroads, right? So as I was looking through the sources, you know, most of this race stuff was not in the dissertation, right? Because that wasn't the lens I was thinking of, that was not the analytical categories that were in my mind as I was finishing my aides, right? And I was getting my dissertation. But as I was looking and rewriting the book after getting my PhD, this race stuff really started to stick out to me. And I noticed that it was an important lens through which both British and Egyptian nationalist authorities talked about and viewed these migrant laborers, right? So for the British, the ELC was just one part of what they called the colored labor corps. And this colored labor corps, or also known as the native labor corps in the British sources, it included workers from Egypt, but also from places as far flung as China, South Africa, India, Vietnam, the West Indies, the Caribbean, and Fiji. So people from all over the world were brought together in this organization, which was called the Colored Labor Corps. And what I argue in the book is that this was the clearest example for the whole world to see what African Americans had recognized for at least a generation as the color line, right? So Frederick Douglass, as far as I can tell, is the first individual to talk about the color line. In 1881, He wrote a piece called The Color Line, where he talked about the system of racial segregation in the American South after the failure of Reconstruction. And of course, it was W.E.B. Du Bois, a generation later, who reformulated The Color Line on a global scale, right? And in the year 1900, he gave an address to the American Negro Academy, which would become the NAACP, where he insisted that, quote, the color line belts the world. And the problem of the 20th century is to be the relation of the civilized world to the dark races of mankind, end quote. So what I argue in the book is that this global problem identified by Du Bois in 1900 was made acute in 1914 to 1918 during the First World War, by this massive movement of racialized laborers from across the globe. And that as the war ground on, millions of people from the other side of the global color line began to resist this unprecedented approach to race, this binary approach of white versus non-white that the color line implies, which was not the way that most people thought about race in Egypt, at least before the First World War. So that's why the ELC makes sense to think about in terms of race from the British perspective, right? For them, the Egyptians are just another group of people of color who we can tap to be source of manpower as we're prosecuting our colonial wars. But for people living in Egypt, the sight of young men being sent away from their villages to work abroad, and oftentimes they were, as I mentioned, they were brought by force, so they're bound together by a thick rope that's tied around their trunk. And as Egyptians saw young men being led away in scenes like this, it was reminiscent of nothing for them if not slavery, right? And we see this metaphor popping up a lot, and I'm going to be talking about this metaphor in the Egyptian sources. And the reason this metaphor is significant to me is because actually slavery was a very widespread institution in Egypt, right? By the late 19th century, most enslaved people, and especially enslaved young men engaged in hard labor, were Black Africans, right? And even after slavery was officially abolished in 1877 in Egypt, it persisted surreptitiously alongside a link between Blackness, African origins, and enslavement in Egyptian culture. So the way I see it, when urban educated Egyptians from the cities saw farmers from the countryside, whom they had over the past generation come to perceive as almost the repository of Egyptianness or Egyptian national authenticity. The Arabic word we see here is Masriya, right? The Fellahin were considered to be kind of the repository of Masriya, right? And when the Fellahin are all of a sudden being seemingly enslaved in large numbers, I think that this gives urbane Egyptian nationalists, really it makes clear to them that Egyptians as a whole had been racialized as people of color during the war. And I argue that the 1919 revolution should be seen partly as an attempt to articulate an alternative conception of Egyptian race, right? So we are not people of color, but we are Egyptians as a race. And I call this racial nationalism. And so we can talk more about racial nationalism and this concept in the Q&A if you want, but that's the basic argument of the book. And that's a selection from the intro. And what I'm going to do now is read a little selection that focuses more on the argument about Egyptian racial nationalism and how it evolved over time. So I'm going to start where chapter one begins, with the story of the Goeben and the Breslau. These are two German warships that were pursued by the British Navy after World War I began in August of 1914, and they escaped the British Navy and found refuge in the Ottoman Navy in August of 1914, right? So let's pick the story up there. On August 16th, 1914, the Ottoman Empire violated its official neutrality in the First World War by accepting two German warships, including the Goeben, as you can see here, into its navy. But despite this defiance, the British officials in Egypt were hesitant to supplant Ottoman sovereignty. And this is a bit of a puzzle for me, right? The Ottomans are violating their neutrality. Why don't the British just declare Egypt as officially a British colony and terminate official Ottoman sovereignty which had been kind of a veil over the Veiled Protectorate in Egypt for so long. And to me, I think the reason why the British did not initially do this in August of 1914 has to do with their fears about what they call pan-Islamism, right? So documents in the British archives paint a picture of a colonial government, the Anglo-Egyptian government, which was concerned at the prospect of what they called pan-Islamic feelings and stirring those feelings if they were to declare war on the Ottoman Sultan, who called himself, of course, the Caliph at the time. So in the British imagination, pan-Islamism, or what other scholars have referred to as the racialization of Muslims, connected two large hubs of the British Empire, India and Egypt, with the Ottomans. And one British official in 1914 even attributed anti-colonial nationalism in India and Egypt to the Ottomans, writing, "As long as Turkey claims to be the secular champion of Islam, its every act in Muslim countries, for example, India and Egypt, must savor a political pan-Islamic propaganda. Similarly, Egyptian nationalism or Young Egypt and Indian nationalism in the case of the Mohammedans are cognate and sympathetic movements tinged with and inherently indistinguishable from pan-Islamism." So you can see that in a letter from Mallet to Gray here. And I think this designation of the Ottoman Empire as the secular champion of Islam kind of strikes us today as a contradiction, right? How can one be the secular champion of Islam? But for British officials in 1914, there was actually significant overlap between concepts like empire, religion, and race, right? So I think it's really crucial to understand that before the war broke out, Muslims were thought about almost in racial terms. And Egyptians were considered to be Muslims, right? So Egyptians were kind of racialized as Muslims in this sense, right? By the time of the war, British officials posited the existence of a number of what they called subject races, right? And this included what they referred to as the Mohammedan race, the black race, and the yellow race. And in one letter from the consul general in Egypt at the time, Herbert Kitchener, we can really see how the racialization of Egyptians as Muslims informed imperial policy in the years before the war. So writing to the Foreign Secretary Gray in 1912, Kitchener is seeking here to justify his attempts to limit self-government in Egypt. And he writes a quote that I think is really illuminating, so I'm going to quote from it at length. He says, "Orientals differ so fundamentally from Western races in their characteristics, principles, and in the working of their minds that the constitutional institutions which have developed as the result of years of experience in Western life fails to meet their requirements." Sounds a little bit like what some Egyptians are still saying today, but this is Kitchener back in 1912. He says, "We are bound to consider carefully whether the endowment of a Mohammedan country with a political system copied from Europe might not do incalculable harm." And this is, I think, the key point. He says, "Although among the people of Egypt there exists a very natural aspiration towards progressive constitutional government, party spirit is to them like strong drink to uncivilized African natives." So I think this quote is illuminating for a number of reasons. We see that Kitchener is defining Egyptians and other Mohammedan countries, quote unquote, as fundamentally different from Western races in both civilizational and biological terms. But at the same time, at the end of this passage, we can see the ambivalent relationship between Muslims and what Kitchener calls uncivilized Africans. In his mind, there appears to exist a unique Islamic form of civilization, which defines Muslims as somewhere above Africans, yet still below the Western races. And at the same time, the racialization of Muslims in the eyes of men like Kitchener rendered both Egyptians as Muslims and Africans unfit for self-rule, right? So there's a clear distinction between Egyptians as Muslims and Africans, but they're both not fit for self-rule. So Egyptian intellectuals are aware that men like Kitchener are saying these types of things, and they pushed back against the implications of this racialization of Muslims ideology by calling for political independence for themselves. But most Egyptians did not reject, or at least Egyptian nationalists, did not reject the fundamental assumption that human beings are naturally divided into biologically distinct, hierarchically organized communities. or racist, right? And while the Pan-Africanist Edward Blyden and the African-American Frederick Douglass looked to the Mohammedan race and Egyptians to learn lessons relevant to the struggles of Black people, the famous Egyptian nationalist Mustafa Kemal looked to Japan. And in his 1904 treatise of Shams al-Mushrika, The Rising Sun, Kemal wrote, "Some of us Oriental races," and the phrase that he uses here is ma'ashir sharqiyin. They said that they are nations whose time has passed, but the Japanese nation resisted this lie, showing all of the Orientals, of sharqiyin ajma'in, that there is a simple path in front of them for their advancement. So here, Kemal is using a word from classical Arabic that refers to tribal genealogy, right, ma'ashir, to assert the existence of Oriental races, ma'ashir sharqiyin, which are distinct from one another, yet in a similar position vis-a-vis the West. And of course, Kemal is writing this about Japan, right, in 1904. So the following year, Japan, of course, defeats Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, and this global pushback against the rising tide of white Christian imperialism emanating from Europe from the late 19th century seems to be gaining momentum with this Japanese victory. So by 1914, when the war begins and when the Goban and the Breslau make their way into Istanbul, British officials are anxious. They're worried about the effects to be produced in places like India and Egypt by the likely visit of Turkish dreadnoughts flying the Caliph's flag to Alexandria or Port Said or Aden or Bombay or the Persian Gulf. It doesn't really make a difference where, if you think about Muslims as a race, right? So the British try to walk a delicate line at the beginning of the First World War. They want to assert their prerogatives in the new war while also appealing to the states in their empire that they had racialized as Muslim. And so they try to maintain cordial relations with the Ottoman Caliph and keep the war isolated to just Europe, right? But of course, the dynamic begins to shift in late October when the Ottoman Navy used the Goban and the Breslau in a bombardment of Russia in the Black Sea. And British administrators, of course, felt compelled to respond to this. So on November 2nd, 1914, John Maxwell, the commander of British occupation troops, announced a policy of martial law in Egypt. And 5 days later, he announced that Great Britain was at war with the Ottoman Empire. It terminated official Ottoman sovereignty in Egypt for the first time, right? So since 1882, the British have been occupying Egypt, but they haven't officially terminated Ottoman sovereignty yet until this moment in November 7th, 1914. But when they do so, John Maxwell, the commander of the British troop forces, the troops that are occupying Egypt, he makes this declaration, right? He says, basically, you can read it here, basically, we're not going to pull Egyptians into the war. We're not going to ask Egyptians to participate into this war, right? So why does he do this? I argue because he's worried that Egyptians are going to revolt and join the Caliph, right? He's thinking about Egyptians as Muslims. And so a war against the Ottomans is potentially disastrous, right? So I argue that this gesture is designed to provide the political cover that the British needed to start fighting the Ottomans. But the following week, something really important happens. The Ottoman Caliph, the Sultan, declares a jihad, a holy war, against the British. And what do Egyptians do? Not much. They don't rise up. They don't start a revolution. They don't fight. And my argument is that this totally changes the way that the British perceive Egyptians, right? When they're not responding to this call for jihad. And this emboldens the British authorities. And by the end of 1914, they officially terminate Ottoman suzerainty over Egypt. They install the oldest living descendant of Mehmet Ali as the official head of state with the new title of Sultan, right? So they're taking that title from the Ottomans. And Egypt is henceforth considered a British protectorate for the first time, right? Alongside a number of other protectorates that are in Southeast Asia, the Persian Gulf, and Africa. So the Maxwell Declaration, of course, then is soon violated, right? As soon as they realize that Egypt, that there is no risk of Egyptians rising and joining the jihad, now they can start recruiting Egyptians for migrant labor as much as they want to, start treating them like any other old group that would provide manpower to the British Army. This is the roots of the decision to start the Egyptian Labor Corps, right? That's what I think. And you can see that the Egyptian labor corps were spread chronologically and geographically, right? They start out in Palestine, of course, but also in the Dardanelles and the Gallipoli campaign. And as the Palestine campaign takes off, you can see that this is the primary source of demand for Egyptian labor. But they're also traveling to Iraq, traveling to France, traveling to Italy, Libya, Sudan, right? And the campaigns against the Senussia and against Ali ibn Dinar in Darfur. Egyptians are serving in all of these places, right? So to paraphrase Ernest Hemingway, the way that I see this, the color line in Egypt was drawn slowly and then all at once, with the First World War exposing the fundamental binary logic at the heart of colonial racism for all to see. Over the course of the 19th century, Egyptians had drifted away from an Ottoman-oriented Islamic civilization and become associated instead in the minds of imperial administrators with a British-dominated Mohammedan race. That's where Kitchener was at in 1912. But total war against the Ottomans lifted the veil on the British occupation of Egypt and exposed what had appeared to be an intricate taxonomy of racial difference that separated, for example, Muslims from Black Africans as a simple global color line that divided the world into white and non-white races. And the British made the promise of the Maxwell Declaration because they had long racialized Egyptians as Muslims and were anxious about pan-Islamic sympathies. But during the war, the racialization of Egyptians as Muslims was displaced by a simpler notion of Egyptians as people of color. So that's kind of the first part of the story, right? Egyptians shifting to being thought about as Muslim in race to now being thought about as people of color alongside Africans and others from across the globe, right? And most of the middle of the book talks about the experiences of the men of the ELC, the racialized abuse that they were subject to as they were working in the war. I have examples of British referring to Egyptians with the N-word. They were flogged, they were whipped at a time when British troops, it was outlawed to flog British infantry troops in the 19th century, but the British were still using these techniques of whips and flogging with Egyptian laborers in the early 20th century during World War I, right? And I have some pictures here that kind of illustrate this a little bit. So you can see the men here. These men are working on a road. The four men to the right, they have the kind of the base stones that would be laid out on the roads in Palestine. The man on the left has a bucket full of gravel that would fill in the spots between the stones. The man in front is known as the Ra'is or a foreman. And the British created kind of internal organization within these companies where they promoted certain laborers to foremen and had them kind of manage the process. Another thing that you can see here, perhaps if you look closely, is this man is not wearing shoes. So in many cases, the Egyptians were not provided with footwear, and this was justified on the basis of their supposed racial characteristics. The British would write that the fellaheen have soles on their feet that are as tough as leather, and so they don't need shoes, even though they're working on the rocky hills of Palestine here. So I think that visually illustrates some of what I'm talking about in terms of the racialized abuse they were subjected to. Here's a picture that I got from the YMCA archives, because the YMCA also was involved in the First World War in Palestine and Egypt. On the far left, you can see the man's tunic says ELC on it. So that's the official Egyptian Labor Corps uniform, right? As these men were taken from the countryside and they moved to places like France or Palestine or Italy or Gallipoli, they were transformed along the way. They actually had all their body hair shaved off of. They were sanitized with heavy de-lousing soap, and they were given uniforms, and they were subjected to military discipline. So they could be tried by field general court-martial, and some of them were killed. They were executed for protesting against their British officers. Two of the key characters from the book you can see here, there's Ernest Venables on the left and Abdelhamid Mohammed Hussein. On the right here, this is the only biography of an ELC laborer that I've been able to find. They didn't leave behind a lot of written accounts. That's one of the big struggles in researching them. But the guy on the left, Venables, he wrote a ton. He wrote letters home. He wrote diaries. He wrote a book that was never published. And I was able to find all these resources and talk about them in the book. Okay, so I have about 10 minutes now. So what I want to do is move on, talk about the 1919 revolution. And in the book, I talk about the symbolic and the practical role that the ELC played in the 1919 revolution. I'm going to start by focusing on the symbolic role. And if we have time, I'll get into the practical stuff. But I think the symbolic stuff really helps us see the next evolution of the next step in the evolution of Egyptian racial nationalism or ideas about the racial identity of Egyptians. So as the war ended, nationalist politicians in Egypt struggled to organize a waft or a delegation to participate in the Paris Peace Conference. And the waft would go on to become the most popular political party in interwar Egypt. Their leader was this man, Saad Zaghlul. And he was the oldest son of an Omda. He was born the oldest son of an Omda of a village in the Nile Delta. And at the age of 14, he moved to Cairo to study at Al-Azhar University, where he studied under luminaries of Islamic modernism like Jamaluddin al-Afghani and Muhammad Abdu. But Zaghlul soon traded in his Azhari robes for the suit of a modern gentleman. In 1893, while he was working as a lawyer, he met two influential young journalists who were speaking out against the British occupation, Ahmed Lutfi Said and Ismail Sidki. And in the book, I talk about Ahmed Lutfi Said in particular and the role that social Darwinism played in some of his thinking. For Zaghlul, I think Ahmed Lutfi Said's main influence was pushing him towards nationalism and this idea of, instead of thinking about Egypt as pan-Islamic, thinking about Egypt and indigenous Egyptians as the real Egyptians, right? As those who the country of Egypt was meant for in a way, right? Saad Zaghlul sort of gets exposed to these ideas and he continues his career in government. In 1906, he's named Minister of Education, where he famously clashes with his British advisor by insisting on Arabic as the language of instruction. And in 1913, he wins a seat on the Legislative Assembly, which is an experiment in self-rule for Egyptians under the British occupation. But then the war breaks out and the Legislative Assembly gets canceled and martial law gets instituted. So Zaghlul loses that job. As the war is coming to an end, Zaghlul starts organizing the waft, starts building support for it, and this brings him into conflict with the British authorities. So on March 8th of 1919, Zaghlul and the leaders of the waft were arrested and exiled to Malta. Soon thereafter, protests broke out in Cairo, and a strike coordinated by a network of middle-class professionals, including lawyers, government employees, students, and religious notables from Al-Azhar spread across the country. At the same time, one of the largest rural rebellions in the history of the modern Middle East took place, with masses of people in villages and towns attacking the infrastructures of the colonial state. The British authorities ultimately relaxed their pressure on the waft, allowing Saad Zaghlul and his colleagues to travel to Paris, and they began negotiating with them in a process that would ultimately lead to a unilateral and highly conditional drawdown of British troops in Egypt. In the meantime, the army, the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, which was just sent to conquer Syria, is now let loose in the Egyptian countryside and used to crush the rural rebellions, right? The Egyptian Expeditionary Force kills approximately 3,000 Egyptians over the course of a couple months in the spring of 1919. And this episode, taken together, is known in Egyptian historiography as the 1919 Revolution. And popular memory in Egypt has enshrined it as the founding moment of the modern Egyptian nation state. So the ELC, I found in my research, played an important symbolic role for nationalist activists and intellectuals during the revolution. In their rhetoric, the men of the waft lambasted the hypocrisy of what the British called voluntary recruitment, insisting instead that what was happening in Egypt was closer to slavery. Representations comparing ELC workers to, for example, black slaves. And here we have a section from Salama Musa's memoir, Tarbiyat Salama Musa, where he describes a trip that he's taking to the countryside and he witnesses a recruiting levy of Egyptian migrant laborers. And he says, it looks like a village of black slaves, Qarya Zanjiya, right? And this word Zanj is an Arabic word that refers particular to black people from the highlands of Tanzania, Kenya, a place where the Abbasid caliphs and others recruited black slaves from traditionally. Another place where we see such representations is in the writings of Muhammad Sabri, who was kind of the official historian of the Waqt. And he was known as a Sorboni. So he was the first Egyptian to get a doctorate from the Sorbonne. And he was trained by Alphonse Allard, who was a famous historian of the French Revolution. And his dissertation was about history of the 1919 revolution, treating it like the French Revolution in a sense. And you can see here that he's talking about how Egyptians have suffered, right, from being called the N-word, and how numerous ignorant functionaries have been treating them poorly. And he says, you know, they're acting like Egyptians have been imported into their own country, and they're men of color who have been introduced to their own country, right? So I think here, Mohamed Sabri perhaps is relating what he's seeing with Egyptians to what he's seeing in France, right, during the war. He's actually studying in the Sorbonne during the First World War. But the key part here is this notion that Egyptians are being treated like men of color, right? And that's a bad thing, right? That's insulting to Mohamed Sabri. I think the most interesting, perhaps, piece of evidence that I found was in the French archives. And this is a petition from an anonymous lawyer who calls himself Abu Shadi. And most of the petition deals with this incident of gang rape that took place in Nezat Oshoba during the 1919 revolution. But it's this line in the beginning that's really interesting to me, right? لِأَنْ كَانَتْ إِنْ كُتَارَ تُرِيدَ أَنْ تَفْتَارَ الْمَصْرِيِّينَ وَهُوشْ إِفْرِيقِيَا. The Egyptians are, or the British are treating the Egyptians like African savages, right? And so I think that he's talking about the Egyptian labor corps here, right? He doesn't specifically mention this, but he's focused on Nezat Oshoba in the petition. But I think here he's really talking about the Egyptian labor corps and how these scenes remind him of African savages, right? And so the question to me is, what do these representations do? How do these representations generate political support and mobilizing force for a revolutionary and nationalist program? And to me, I think these representations drew their mobilizing force from popular conceptions of Egyptian national identity that posited Egyptian racial difference from and superiority to Black Africa. At the same time, the good works of the ELC and their contributions to British victory in the war were taken to undermine claims of white political supremacy. So it's paradoxical here. The 1919 revolution is an anti-racist act against white supremacy, against the British presence in Egypt. At the same time, it creates mobilizing force by drawing on notions of Egyptian racial superiority to Black Africans. So in response to the racialization of Egyptians as people of color, I argue that nationalist politicians and public intellectuals centered the Fellaheen, like the men of the ELC, as the true symbols of Egyptian national and racial authenticity. The dominant discursive mode of nationalism that emerged in the decade or so after the revolution, which posited a biological and cultural link between modern Egyptians, especially the Fellaheen, who were seen as kind of an endogamous, pure group of Egyptians that was isolated from the diversity and multiple different groups that existed in the cities, right? So these Fellaheen were considered to be especially linked to the ancient pharaohs. And I think that this notion of a social group that is reproduced biologically through time is similar to ideas about race science that were circulating in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And so I think that Farinism, and I'm going to be exploring this more actually in a talk next week at SUNY Old Westbury, but I think Farinism, which is super popular now for people like Assisi, is a version of Egyptian racial nationalism. And this discourse of Farinism worked to differentiate political leaders like Saad Zaghlul and Salama Musa and Mohamed Sabri and many of these canon figures of Egyptian nationalism that I've been talking about. They were all rural to urban, middle-class strivers who were born in the countryside, and therefore were got their bona fides to represent Egypt on the national stage as a result of their rural descent and parentage. And they were also tried to position themselves as heirs to an ancient civilization. That's what the pharaohs allowed Egyptians to claim, is that Egyptians are also a civilization, right? And therefore that they are not deserving of imperial subordination. So it's 543. I'm going to end it there, talking about the symbolic role of the ELC. We can talk more about the practical role if you want to in the Q&A. But I think what I've done here is kind of sketch out the skeletal argument I'm making about Egyptian racial identity, how Egyptians get racialized as Muslims and then people of color. And then the 1919 revolution is about presenting an alternative picture of Egyptian race at a time when race was really an active category for everybody across the political spectrum, and that it was pharaohism that was kind of that last iteration of Egyptian racial nationalism. So, and for those of you Iranian scholars, I think there's a good parallel here to Aryanism and what Reza Zia Ibrahimi calls dislocative nationalism, right? I'm using the term racial nationalism, dislocative nationalism, kind of a clunky term. I think racial nationalism encapsulates more what is going on here in the late 19th and early 20th century when Iranians are talking about the Aryans or when Egyptians are talking about the pharaohs. And I think it also really helps us think about fascism in the region and how fascism evolves and how fascism has sort of taken root today to some extent. So we can talk about this more in the Q&A, but I'll leave it at that. And thanks, guys, for your time.
Thank you very much, Kyle. I have a question online, but why don't we start with questions here in our live audience?
Sure. Yeah.
You'd like to stop sharing.
Yeah. That's the thing.
There we go.
I see a couple questions. Yeah.
Hi. I really enjoyed this talk, and it resonates with so many things that have been wrong. I think that I also remember the diaspora in this period. So one of the things that really struck me is that at the time they're making this differentiation between being Egyptian and being Black, you had that.
And now.
Yes.
We're listening.
Okay, but you have people celebrating Egypt as this example of Black capacity for empire building and monumental architecture, all that stuff. And so it's also interesting to think about, or to wonder what sort of conversations happened at the in Paris in 1919, because you have the boys and all those people who were there at the same time. And so I wonder if there was any sort of dialogue or conversation between them. The other thing that comes to mind is how you describe in the what becomes defined as Egyptian nationalism. Actually reminds me very much of what the Cubans do, because part of what Jose Marti does is to, in a sense, erase race as a component within Cuban nationalism. So everybody becomes Cuban. And they're not going to make distinctions between the Afro-Cubans and those who are of Spanish heritage. And it's a conversation that's happening, or an attempt to define this, roughly the same period. Probably, in fact, by 1912, then you had the massacre in Cuba where they do try to exterminate Blacks after they formed the Independent Party of Color. And so it's just an interesting contrast to look at how nation and race are being negotiated in these different spaces.
Definitely. I mean, the Cuban example is not one that I've read up on a lot, and I think that I would love to read more about it, because one of the challenges and things that I've tried to undertake in this book is reading widely in the period and trying to draw connections across the globe instead of being so focused and centered in the Egyptian nation state, which is what I was trained to do. And I'm sure there are a lot of parallels there. Of course, you know, this idea of there being no difference between Afro-Cubans and Spanish descended Cubans, on the one hand, one could look at this and say this is kind of an admirable attempt at civic nationalism. But on the other hand, I think when we look at the Arab world and in Turkey and in Iran, efforts to create national identities that don't acknowledge the unique position of African descended people in these countries has had the tendency to kind of just erase these people entirely. So I know that some of our colleagues in the room are working on this issue in Iran. And I think in Egypt too, there have been multiple generations of scholars who have almost just ignored the slave trade and ignored the role of Ottoman imperialism in Africa, for example, that Dr. Manawi here has so rightly pointed to in his work. So one of the challenges that we have coming out of this is kind of recovering the legacy of the African slave trade and the unique position that African descended people have been in, because there are no census categories that capture the existence of this population, right? And then, you know, as to the relationship between nation and race, I mean, I really think that there was a time in which these two terms were almost synonymous. Mm-hmm. You hear things like talking about the Irish race, or, even in all over the world, I think we see race science becoming extremely influential at around the same time that nationalism is gaining broad purchase globally. And I really think it's only in the wake of, in my mind, the wake of the Second World War, and as we start to see the results of National Socialism in the death camps and how important race was to the Nazi ideology, social scientists start to say, well, this is a bad concept. We shouldn't think about this. We should ignore this. And what ends up happening is we kind of forget how important this concept was for people all across the political spectrum, because nobody wanted to associate themselves with race after Hitler and the fascists made it look so bad. So so I do think that that race and nation were synonymous, and at a time or perhaps in the minds of some people at least, and then as time goes on, the two words become kind of decoupled in a way. And then ask your question about, is there a dialogue between Du Bois and Egypt? I mean, it's interesting, you know, Frederick Douglass was in Egypt in the 1880s. Du Bois and his family, you know, he moves to Ghana in his later life, but his family ends up getting kicked out of Ghana and they relocate in the 70s to Cairo. So those African Americans were in Egypt and they were interested in Egypt and they were interested in learning from Egyptian lessons. Du Bois wrote an article in The Crisis in June of 1919 where he talked about the Egyptian revolution. And in his mind, this is a revolution of Black people, of people of color, of fighting against white supremacy, right? But I think that the ironic part is I don't think Egyptian nationalists would have liked his characterization of their revolution very much. And I think that even though African Americans want to look to Egypt as an example of people of color rising up, Egyptians want to distance themselves from Black Africans at this moment. There is a time, of course, when Pan-Africanism becomes more important in Egypt politically. And even then, under the Nasser period, as Ibrahim knows and as many others know, it's complicated, right? Nasser tries to be a Pan-Africanist. At the same time, he signs an agreement with Ethiopia to get a larger share of the Nile River waters to Egypt, and he tries to reconquer Sudan in different ways using soft power, right? That Pan-African moment is there in Egyptian history, but it's not there in 1919, and it's not there in the 1920s. It's not until later that Pan-Africanism starts to gain some purchase in Egypt. Before that, Egyptians are trying to articulate a distinct sense of Egyptian racial identity that's not about, in my mind, building solidarity with Black Africans. And if I'm wrong about that, I would love for somebody to prove me wrong. I would love to read more about that period. I just haven't found those sources. And when I look to the sources, this is what I see. Wahusha Frikia, Zanj, you know? And that's significant to me. Yeah, Mustafa.
Was there someone else before me? Or because you said there's a couple of questions. Is that
Ross, I saw your hand up.
Yeah, I need order to respond.
Go for it, Ross.
Okay. Yeah, I think your shift in emphasis towards race and development of identity among Muslims is really fascinating. I had a couple questions. One is, how, if at all, did the presence of Coptic community complicate this idea of the, you know, Islam being a race, but the Muslims being racialized? And then the other one is, if you could just clarify a little more how you were interpreting the term Zenj, what precisely you were defining it as.
So Zenj, to me, means basically Black slaves, right? I think it refers to Black people from Black Africans from a particular region, right? The highlands of Tanzania and Kenya. But this is the region where the Abbasids and others got their Black slaves from. And in Egypt, there comes a time when particular labels for different communities in Africa, like there are moments where Mustafa Kamel, for example, will refer to the Mahdi uprising in Sudan and he'll call them Zanj, right? And he's not talking about Tanzania and Kenya, right? He's talking about Black people. But why does he use this term Zanj? To me, the term is linked with slavery, right? And so some people, I see Mustafa shaking his head, right? And I've seen some people translate this as like Negro, for example, right? But I think that even if that's the translation, I think the word signifies a sense of, for lack of a better term, kind of anti-Blackness within the that has deep roots in the Arabic language, right? And so when Salama Musa is looking at a village in Zagazig and he's saying that this reminds him of the Zanj, I think what he's saying is that these Egyptians look like slaves, but he doesn't use Abid, you know? He's saying that they look like slaves and they look like Black slaves to me. Like, I don't think, you know, he's looking at these guys being tied up. Even if you translate Zanj as Negro there, what does that mean? To look at men being tied up and led away and to say they look like Negroes, what are you saying about Black people? You know, I think that there's a link between Blackness, trans-Saharan origins and slavery in Egyptian popular culture at this time. And a guy like Salama Musa, for those of you who are familiar with him, I mean, his antipathy towards Black Africans is well attested. He is very interested in eugenics. When he goes over to London, he becomes the foreign correspondent of Al-Muqtam and Al-Muqtataf, writing about the eugenics laboratories that are being founded in London. And the people at Al-Muqtataf, and these are not progressive people, are like, man, you're too into this eugenics stuff. You're too anti-Black, you know? So he even gets into a fight with guys like Ferris and Nimr, who are like the biggest supporters of the British occupation in Egypt at the time. And even they think that his eugenics is over the top. But that could be, you know, something we talk about, this word Zanj. Your second question was about the Copts. And I think that one of the interesting things that's happening over the course of the British occupation is reforms within the interior ministry. One of the reforms the British make, for example, they make it so that every omda, the mayor basically of every village, has to be a Muslim. And they make this decision because they define Egypt as a Muslim country. The cops at the same time are struggling with this idea of being a minority and kind of pushing against that label that's been applied to them. I think there's a sense in which there's also, for example, Boutros Ghali, right, who gets assassinated in 1910, the Coptic prime minister. He's seen as kind of a comprador or a collaborator with the British. So if the British are this colonial authority and they're ruling over this population that they define as Muslim, the Christians within that population become a kind of, they occupy this kind of liminal space where to some extent they become kind of allies with the British, and then at other times what the British are doing by defining Egyptians as Muslims is really alienating them and making it harder for them as well. But I think most importantly, I mean, one of the big things about Farinism is that it rejects this, right? Farinism says, no, Egyptians are not Muslims. Egyptians are Egyptians. And so the Copts and the Muslims and the Jews at the time can all get together and take pride in their descent from the pharaohs, right? So that's one aspect of the 1919 revolution, I think, that pushes back against the history of race and the way that the British have tried to racialize Egyptians.
I have a question personally, and I also have a question online. So I'm going to ask the question from online. This is Catherine Kocken asking, is there any evidence of literacy of the Egyptian labor corps, any written records of their experiences? You mentioned that there were few written records.
Is that the question? That's the end of the question.
That's the end of that question. But I see that she put the second question, so I will ask the second question, which is: in 1910, the dreadnought hoax in Britain was a spectacular event—a practical joke involving Cambridge students impersonating Abyssinian officials to view the latest warship in the British Navy named the Dreadnought. Virginia Woolf was one of these hoaxers. It would be interesting to look at the period leading up to the period of the First World War, and I mean, you can hear, I guess, what's going on in Britain. As far as how they are viewing Egyptians in terms of
this. Well, I don't know anything about the Dreadnought hoax, but that's interesting, and I'll have to look into it. The question of literacy and written records, I mean, there's been a lot of work in the past 5 years or so that's tried to push back against sort of dichotomy between literate and illiterate. There are a lot of people who have sort of some mastery over writing, but they perhaps can't write a book. But the important thing is that Egyptian labor corps men did not leave behind a lot of written sources for us, whether that was because they were illiterate or because they were too busy working. Seems the result is the same anyways. So we do have one brief sort of 3.5-4 page memoir of an Egyptian labor corps worker. And then there's reports that refer to letters that Egyptian labor corps men would write home. But I haven't found a single letter. I haven't found the censor's office that might have records of these letters. The best we can do, I think, is try to get in touch with surviving family members of the Egyptian labor corps. And that's not something that I've really been able to do, but I think it's something that my book is hopefully starting a conversation within Egypt to get some of these family members to sort of share what's happened with them. But long story short, we don't have a lot of written records. I try to get around this by focusing on sound, songs, and embedded colloquial Arabic in the poorly transliterated colloquial Arabic in the writings of British officials, and theater, Sufi rituals. These kinds of things are recorded by observers. And so I try to focus on sound in chapter 6 of the book. Thanks also to Ziad for that.
Yeah, I'm so glad you went in this direction. It's really, really rich. And I happen to be also thinking about questions of race, but for me, race seems to always intersect with class in the Middle East at that time. So I wanted to ask you, in the Egyptian case, how does notions of race map on to the different classes that make up the Egyptian people from the perspective of the British, but also from the perspective of the Egyptians that are writing that are from a specific class, and some of them, not even Arabic speakers, or at least Arabic speakers only in public. So how does that fit into this?
Egypt is a unique case within the Ottoman Empire. I think the way that I see it is I associate Saad's Ağlul and the leaders of the 1919 revolution with a movement to redefine the dominant political community in Egypt as indigenous Egyptians. So before the 1919 revolution, throughout the 19th century, as you know, the Ottomans are coming in. They've reasserted their control in Egypt under Mehmet Ali. Ali and the class, the upper class of people that he creates below him, are importing concubines from the Caucasus, and most of the elite upper class Egyptians by the end of the 19th century have white mothers, and they have Turkish or Ottoman fathers. And as the middle class is struggling against this Turco-Circassian class, they start to articulate a notion of the Egyptian Ummah, the community, as indigenous Egyptians, right? And so I think there's a sense in which it's the middle class that is defining itself as Egyptian. And they are also then reading race science and having a kind of organic conception of Egyptians as a people, where they think about themselves as, I've seen different metaphors, the head, the soul of the Egyptian Ummah, right? So because they are Egyptians and because they are upper class, they can claim, or middle class, they're educated, they've traveled back and forth between the countries and the countryside and the cities, they can claim to represent both working class Egyptians and all Egyptians as the head, the part of the body, of the organic unity of Egyptians that is tasked, that has the function of writing and representing and engaging in politics, right? So, and there's also a sense at the same time in which the Fellaheen are grouped alongside black slaves in different moments, like Mehmet Ali's army, where he's conscripting Fellaheen and he's also importing black slaves from Sudan as infantry troops, or on the Delta plantations, the Azab, which are harvesting cotton. There's a census that takes place in 1848. There's another one that takes place in 1868. In these censuses, there are significant proportions of the population that are black African slaves in the countryside, up to 5% in some villages in the Delta. So you have enslaved black Africans working alongside the Fellaheen, who are also coerced in some senses in different laws that force them to be on their land, and the corvée and the sokra and different types of coercive labor regimes. So on one hand, the middle class is trying to say, look, we're all Egyptians here, and us as the middle class, we have the right to represent you as lower class Egyptians because we're all Egyptians, but we're the ones that are the head. And then on the other hand, Egyptian Fellaheen are being put in positions that are analogous to black slaves at different times. So those dynamics are rather complex, I would say. But I think the important thing is that it's the middle class in Egypt that's trying to represent Egyptians as a organic totality. And in doing so, they claim to represent the lower class Egyptians. And we can also go, and there's recent articles that talk about the Sa'id, different parts of Egypt, where the Sa'idis are considered to be perhaps of a different race, right? Are treated like Wahoosh, savages or barbarians, right? And certain characters from the Sa'id, and Ziad talks about this in his book, but I'll also, there's an article that came out in Ijmis a couple issues ago about Rai of Sakina, how they were being portrayed, these are two famous serial killers in Egypt, and how they were being portrayed as particularly barbarous and savage because of their Upper Egyptian origins. So there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm not really sure how it all maps onto each other and what's the overarching framework in which we can think about this, but the intersections between class and race are definitely there, but they don't map onto each other perfectly. And I think there are, for the middle class in Egypt, there's some times where it benefits them to present Egyptians as a race. And then there's other times where it benefits them to say, we're upper class, we're better, you know, we're different than these other Egyptians who you are, you know, calling whatever, treating in a certain kind of way. So that's an important question that I think more people need to think about.
Can I ask just a quick follow-up?
Absolutely,
still class, middle class, and where does being Arab fit into all this? When Arab is becoming an identified as an ethnicity?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't think it's there yet in 1919. Mm-hmm. You know, you go back and you look, for example, at Sharif Hussein's efforts to negotiate an Arab kingdom with the British. Mm-hmm. Egypt is nowhere in that kingdom. Perhaps the British cooperation with Sharif Hussein during the First World War makes, and the Egyptian antipathy towards the British at the same time, makes identification with the Arab cause particularly fraught around the time of the First World War. But I don't think it's until the interwar period that Egyptians really start to identify with Arab as an ethnicity. To me, the vector for this is the Palestinian cause. And Egyptians, I think, begin to identify parallels between their own situation and the situation of Palestinians, who are also subject to British colonial rule in the interwar period. And it is as the Palestinian cause becomes this cause celeb in Egypt that Egyptians begin to identify as Arabs. I don't think it's until the 20s and the 30s, especially the 36 Arab revolt, where this really takes off in Egypt. But that's actually what I'm thinking about for my next book, asking how is it that Egypt entered the 48 war? And I think a lot of it has to do with these shifting notions of Egyptian identity. But in the 20s, it's pharaohs. We're the pharaohs. We're not Arabs. We're not Muslims. We're not people of color. We are the pharaohs. And, you know, and it vacillates. I think now in the present day, Egypt has this reservoir of, it's almost like a palimpsest. It's been layered over and over. And now the leaders can kind of call on these different identifications at different moments, right? So there's moments when it's politically advantageous for Assisi to say, we're pharaohs. And he puts on these ridiculous parades and, you know, puts the mummies on in the most expensive air sealed boxes while, you know, people are starving on the streets and can't get enough bread. And then there are other times when when Israel is bombing the Gaza and he wants to say, oh, we can step in, we can negotiate, we're politically meaningful because we can mediate between Gaza and Israel, right? Because we're Arabs too. So at different moments, these different identifications become politically beneficial for people like Assisi. And today we're left with this big confused jumble about what is an Egyptian.
So thank you very much. It's really exciting to hear how this project has shifted. And I think I agree, this the work you're doing is really fascinating. I'm thinking, I'm trying to sort of square some of what you're saying with, some of this is a comment and some I think is a question. With the figure of you know, the comic actor Ali Kassar, who is certainly on the stage in this period. I'm not quite sure precisely when his character Osman Abdel Basit is introduced. I don't have that quite in my head. I pick up the story in the 1930s. But his persona is as a Barbari, right? And he wears blackface. And his tagline is like, we are in time, this is an anti-British, we are in time to black in the face. The British are treating us like African slaves, right? Or like Africans, right? So I think on that side of it, it's clear, you know, it's very much in support of the argument that you're making. And I think, you know, this comic take and this, you know, reappropriation of this. You know, and Eve Trappel does, you know, does a good job of, you know, talking about some of the complexities of the wearing the black face and the implications of that, and, you know, in the ways that it's both, you know, sort of politically critical and whatnot. But the other side of this is this character is, he says, I'm half Nubian, half Sudanese, 100% Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, like, where does Egypt's relationship with Sudan with their political designs on Sudan, and how does that all fit into this question of where are the boundaries of Egypt?
Mm-hmm.
And what it means to be Egyptian?
Well, it's extremely complex, but there's a sense in which when Egyptians say that there's no difference between Sudan and Egypt, what they're really trying to do is keep the British from giving Egypt independence and keeping Sudan for themselves, mm-hmm. right? And of course, what the goal is to return to the situation before the British occupation when Egypt ran Khartoum, right, from Cairo, right? So you can look at this and you can say, well, you know, he's saying that Egyptians and Sudanese are the same. Isn't there a kind of solidarity there? But the reason why that sameness is being emphasized is because Egyptians they believe that if Egypt and Sudan are considered, you know, as part of the same family that shouldn't be under British control, then Egyptians would sort of naturally dominate the Sudan, right? So, and remember, this is all going on in the context of the Mahdist revolt and the white flag revolt, which takes place in the 1920s, right? So as the Sudanese are rising up and saying, we are different, we don't want Egyptian control, Egyptians are saying, no, Kulina Masriin Sudaniin, you know, it's all Egyptian Sudanese, right? But there is a way in which this Egyptian Sudanese identity implies the domination of the former over the latter. I think.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you to the online audience as well for joining us. And thank you to everyone who's here and joining me.